tonight I've got Chris Maynard here from Glucose Revival. He is a former Air Force member. He is now a firefighter, first responder. He lives with type 1 diabetes. His son, I believe, yes, son, is on the path to also being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. So we're going to talk about how to adventure safely with diabetes if you live with diabetes. And then also, like, since 49% of U.S. adults are living with diabetes or are pre-diabetic, chances are someday you're going to hike with somebody who might be living with this. So we're going to talk about some safety things to, like, what to look for if somebody's having a distressful situation in a diabetes environment. So we'll talk about what to look for, signs to know, and how to help. And then Gabach is here as well, and we're going to be talking about exploring responsibly. So we're talking about leave no trace, we're talking about the 10 essentials, and most importantly, land acknowledgments. So tonight I am reporting to you live, because this is a new show. I am reporting to you live from the land of the Kumeyaay people. I'm here in Julian, California. Chris is in Spokane, Washington, which is land of the Spokane people. And how about you, Gabacho? What you got going on? Where are you at?
I am in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the land of the Pueblo and Jicarilla Apache people.
Yeah. All right. So we are cruising through it. And Gabach is going to tell us about land acknowledgements and why and how we can do it and why it's important in her segment a little bit later. But Chris is on his, he is sitting at the airport. So let's talk with Chris first. And we'll chat a little bit about safety with diabetes and all of that fun stuff. So Chris, give us a quick intro. Who are you and what is Glucose Revival?
Well, I appreciate the introduction. And Gabacha, I'm going to be speaking for a conference tomorrow morning for Southern New Mexico. So it's a pleasure to meet you as well. I've been a type 1 for 20 years. And in that time, I've been a firefighter as well, nearly the same amount of time. I was kicked out of the military when I was diagnosed. And then about 5 years into my firefighter career, I was taken away from that job when I had a low blood sugar at work. So I lost that for 2 years. So there was a lot of figuring out and adjusting to the life of living with diabetes. Because at that point, I guess I didn't take it as serious as I should be at that point in my life. So there was some maturing, there was some growing. And a few years later, I woke up to an ambulance crew having a severe low while I was camping with my kids, woke up to an ambulance crew administering glucose gel in my mouth. And that was kind of one of those aha moments of what I need to be able to provide for my family and their safety as well, for my safety and for my family's safety. And then, as you said, most recently, our son, we just found out 2 years ago that now we're about 2 years left. We got 2 years to go when he's projected to be a type one as well. So quick rundown of who I am. With those circumstances involved from an EMT's perspective, my own medical alert necklace that contains what EMTs use for low blood sugars. So that that time camping with my family, they could have had, I wouldn't have had to wait 30 minutes for an ambulance crew to arrive. They could have just taken what's inside the necklace and administered it to me. And I could have had that help a lot sooner if I would have had it with me. So that's a quick gist of it.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And I, as a first responder, what are some of the signs? Let's talk about for people hiking with people with diabetes first, and then we can talk about like the precautions you take for yourself when you go out in the wilderness. And I'll talk about the precautions I take for myself as somebody living with type 2. But for folks that aren't familiar with the symptoms of a low blood sugar episode or other diabetes related complications that may happen when we're out in the wilderness, what are some of the signs that people should be looking for and how can they help?
Most commonly it's synonymous or related to being drunk. You're fumbling your speech, you're starting to forget things, but that's not something that anyone else can see unless you're in conversation. It just might be a deep, heavy sweat that's coming on. The heart starts palpating really fast. But it's hard to recognize from someone that really doesn't know you. My wife's really good at telling me, hey, you're experiencing a low blood sugar, whereas nobody where it's rare for others to be able to recognize it. But when it starts getting more to the extreme side, usually I'm not one that gets really tired. So that's a good indicator for me and for others that whether it's I'm just feeling like I need to go lay down, go to sleep, or whether it's just I'm getting slower on the trails.
Yeah. So for me, I had my first and thankfully only so far hypoglycemic episode at a concert. And so it was February last year, so 2019. And the first thing to go was my vision. And it looked like a kaleidoscope through my eyes. And I told my husband, like, we were at a concert and I was like, I think I'm tripping. And he was like, you haven't taken any drugs, so you're definitely not. Okay. And then I couldn't like talk. And the last thing I remember saying before I lost all motor function was I'm diabetic. And so my husband was like, she's got diabetes. Like, and he caught me and our friend Tim caught me as well before I hit the ground. So thankfully I didn't like fall down and hit my head. But I was like a sack of potatoes. Like I had no motor function whatsoever. I couldn't talk. I couldn't see. I could hear. And the only thing that I was really worried about as they were like dragging me out, because my feet were like dragging on the floor and they were kind of pulling me out, the only thing that I could hear was the bouncer telling them to get me out of here because he thought I was drunk. And so my husband, Barry, was like, she's diabetic. We need to get her attention. And fortunately, there was a medic tent outside of the venue and they were able to give me glucose like on site. But the thing, I just remember the thing I was worried about was like my shirt was pulling up as they were dragging me out. And I was like, I don't want anyone to see my tummy. Like, that's what I was worried about as I'm like on the brink of diabetic coma and death on the way out of this venue. I was like, I just don't want someone to see my stomach. That's cute. But it was one of the scariest things I've ever been through. And I think it's important for people listening and watching back on this talk that type 2 diabetics can also experience low blood sugar episodes, because I didn't realize that I could, because I was managing for high blood sugar. So I had adjusted my nutrition plan. At that point, I wasn't on medication anymore, but I was eating what I thought I needed to eat to keep my numbers within a safe range. And I was hiking as much as humanly possible. So I didn't think it was possible for me to go low. So it was really surprising when I did, because I didn't know what was happening. Like, I thought maybe somebody spiked my water, because like I wasn't drinking beer. I wasn't drinking anything. I wasn't on drugs. I was just like, what is happening? And it was really, really scary. So for anybody listening, if you have type 2 diabetes, that is something to be aware of. And if you're adventuring with people with diabetes, let's talk a little bit about your trip and how you prepared for your big hike. You did Mount St. Helens, is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't get to do much preparation for that, only because I tore my MCL not much earlier. So a lot of it was learning on that mountain, because I haven't gone to that extreme before. But so I took everything with me, or pretty much everything with me that I backpack. I had two bladders. One of it was filled with water. The other was filled with Welch's fruit juice, just a ton of carbs. So I got 3 liters of fruit juice in there to be able to help on that respect. And then it's just a matter of all the other proteins and other carbs, the sandwiches, the fruits, everything else that I was carrying with me as well. Of course, and usually I bring one necklace per mile that I go on, just for that extra security as well, so that those with me, if I can't administer it to myself, now they're able to help as well.
So from an education perspective, then when you go hike with folks, you have a necklace and you tell them like, hi, this is what glucose revival is. This is the necklace. This is how you use it. And if I go down, rub this on my gums. Like, how do you prep people for that?
Yeah. Well, usually by the time that I get to that point when I'm hiking with someone else, they know I'm a diabetic and they also know about the product. And so, whether I've shown them to use it or whether I've shown them the videos from the website that they can see and see exactly how it's to be administered. I mean, it's fairly a simple process, because fortunately for this, I mean, the American Diabetes Association recommends that every diabetic carry at least 15 grams with them. And so that's what we did, is we put the 15 grams inside. And so it's a little quick release. I'm going to see if I can set that down real quick. Don't mind.
There you go.
So it's just a little quick release, and then it's uncapped, and then the gel's just inside. So it's almost like a toothpaste container that I can squeeze it out inside my mouth. I can take it myself if I have nothing else. But predominantly I save it for friends or family when I can't administer it to myself.
Very cool. So I really appreciate your packing list. So you take, and living with type 1 diabetes, you have to bring your insulin, you have to bring all that stuff that comes with that. And then in addition to that, a whole liter full of fruit juice just sounds like fun. I mean, like, you don't want to ever have to use that. But when you were saying that that's what you bring, I was like, that's just brilliant. And it's so easy to carry that in that way. So awesome. So for me, when I go out, I am now, like, air quotes, my diabetes has been reversed. So I manage strictly through my nutrition plan, movement, and managing my stress. I'm not on medications. I've never been on insulin. So I'm fortunate in that regard. I was diagnosed early in the progression of the disease and was able to get on top of it pretty quickly. But for me, I always check my blood sugar before I go on a big hike because I want to see, like, where I'm at baseline. If I'm backpacking, I'll bring my glucometer with me. If I'm going on a day hike, generally I don't need it. But I always have either like the honey stinger gels or a tube of like cake frosting, or I really love the ProBar Bolt Energy Chews. Cause like, just because I should have sugars on me, I also don't want to just be eating crap because the doctor said I should. So the ProBar Bolt Chews they're like the Cliff Blocks. Like, they're really good ingredients. They're not going to like make me feel gross, excuse me, after eating it. And I'm lucky that adventuring wise, I haven't had any close calls or any kind of like episodes on the trail. But have you had anything scary happen in your adventures out in the world? I mean, you said you woke up terrified in a tent once camping. Is there more than that?
Well, going up Mount St. Helens, we took 10 diabetics up there. And on the way down, there's a 13-year-old that was with us. For one, it was amazing that a 13-year-old type 1 can make it up, because that to me physically was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And if I wanted to bring my kids to be able to do it, and about halfway up, I was thinking, boy, I'm glad they didn't come because they would have hated this. And I'm thinking, there's still a 13-year-old that's with us. And this kid pushed it through all the way. On the way down, about 2 miles to go left, which is still probably about three hours ahead, he starts experiencing a low blood sugar. He's got nothing else with him. He ran out of water. He ran out of food. He's got nothing with him except for his dad. And so his dad's trying to find stuff. The only thing he had left with him was his necklace. His CGM fell off because of all of his sweat. Insulin pump came off, was the necklace. And so he had one test strip from his glucometer, tested him. He was at 52.
Whoa.
With that necklace being the only thing that he had left. And the unbelievable thing with that story is, up on that mountain, we had cell reception. At the bottom of the mountain, it was almost out. It was non-existent down there. And so we got a message from him saying he's experiencing a low blood sugar. I'm worried for him. And so someone else called an ambulance crew to come in just in case. And it was fun watching him kind of walk across that finish line, because as he said, he didn't need them. But to see him walking on his own two legs, walking past that finish line, was just absolutely unbelievable. 13 years old.
Wow. With like a whole deck of cards stacked against him. He's like, I got this. It's fine. That's great. Well, I'm glad that it hasn't been anything too terrifying. And do you mind telling us a little bit about the experience that you had where you woke up and like people were putting glucose in your mouth? That sounds terrifying.
Well, it's funny because I remember that night real vividly, camping with my kids. I didn't bring backup supplies and my pump got ripped out, and we sitting around the fire and we cook some chili. It's our favorite chili. And I'm just thinking, I can't eat because it's going to skyrocket my blood sugar. I got nothing else. Well, so I found a way to take some insulin out of my pump and inject it in me, but I had no idea how much was going in, all because I wanted to eat some of that chili. And so that's what I did, is I got myself some insulin and then just went to bed later on that night and woke up to an ambulance crew just rubbing it in. And that's my first time waking up to an ambulance crew. Unbeknownst to me, that I got some stranger putting their fingers in my mouth, rubbing it on my gums. I think this is actually unbelievable. It's stuff that I've done as an EMT. I've never had it done to me. And then waking up to a stranger thinking that your kids are the only ones around, and now I got lights flashing outside and I got someone else's fingers in my mouth. This is unbelievable. So
yeah. What did your family, like, what led up to, like, what was the experience like for them? Like, what did they see you experiencing that led them to call the ambulance, that led to a stranger's fingers being in your mouth, rubbing glucose on your gums?
I was convulsing. I wasn't waking up. I mean, they tried to wake me up for some time. They tried to see if, to try to wake me up to give me some juice, but they can't pour juice in my mouth. So that's what led them to calling 911. And being where we were, it's just, we were out in the middle of nowhere. And that's why it took 30 minutes for someone to.
Wow. Whew. That's a lot. So one of the things that I really appreciated about our early conversations when we were first talking about how we can, like, partner together on Take a Hike Diabetes was your desire to unite the diabetes community between pre-diabetic type 1 and type 2. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the community. Like, what is happening between type 1 and type 2 that we can work to unify? Because it sounds like I've heard in my recounting of my experiences as a type 2 diabetic, especially on the internet, there are a lot of people with opinions where they're like, yeah, well, type 1 has it worse, so maybe you should stop complaining. And for sure, there's definitely an entirely different set of considerations for type 1, given that it's autoimmune and there is no cure. But let's talk a little bit about some of the cool stuff that you've seen in the community, because I know you've helped a lot of really awesome athletes in particular with type 1. And then let's talk about how we can unify this community.
I look at it from the type 1 side almost as a sad state. And I see a lot of it come from probably mostly parents of type 1s, because it's their baby. And so I get schooled by the parents on, you have no idea what a type 1 is. Why would you try to, or they're nothing alike. And I guess cancer patients say, well, I wish I had this kind of cancer rather than this kind of cancer. Or if someone broke an arm versus a broken leg, I wish I had one over the other. Because I know type 2s don't want to be a type 2, just like a type 1 doesn't want to be a type 1. But my feeling is, I always relate it to breast cancer, because they've done really well with the pink ribbon. But it took them about 15 years to be able to get the exposure that they did and get it into NFL games. They've just done a phenomenal job. And with that, they were able to increase, just by that exposure, to get the legislators' attention and increase their funding by a multiple of 10. And so what I wish is that the type ones would stop the bickering about we have it worse than type twos and join forces, because 90% of diabetics are type two, is join forces so that, so now that we have a team of 30 million rather than 2 million, so that we can make notice to the legislator and our country, because it helps all of us.
Yeah, I feel like we've got well over 100 million people if we combine us all together. That makes noise, like really loud noise. That is a market you can't deny. Like, one of the things that I'm trying to help the outdoor industry understand about people with diabetes is, like, one, this is a ginormous market that you're not tapping. And, like, at the very, like, if we're going to talk about the dollars and cents and in terms that corporations can understand, y'all can make so much money if you pay attention to this community. Like, there are 100 million plus people who, like, want support and want products and want recognition and all of this stuff. And so, like, not only is it a huge market that I think is incredibly untapped, but also it's the right thing to do, more importantly. So yeah, I'm with you. And I think our new mission, well, our mission as part of this mission in 2021 is, like, let's just do as much as we can as Sydney and Chris, as type one and type two, as all of, as, like, leaders of different communities and organizations to, like, bring this together. Because honestly, like, we're not getting anywhere if we don't unite, like, show up. Because, like, if you have, like, what do you say? It was 1.5 million people with type one. Yeah, like, if we roll up on, like, Capitol Hill with 1.5 million or 100 million, like, we've got 10x people if we combine everybody with pre-diabetics, type 1 and type 2. So I'm with you on that. Let's go change the world, Chris. Let's just make it happen. Well,
and my hope is it's so simple, because, I mean, the pink ribbon isn't cancer. And so the blue circle is our symbol. So I offered to pay, and I've talked to each of the CEOs of the three largest nonprofit diabetic organizations, the ADA, the JDRF, and Beyond Type 1 and 2. I've asked them and told them I would fund it if they would just put the blue circle around their logo, thinking that it just brings more exposure, more unity, and people can start learning from them. And if they learn from the diabetic organizations, then it just bleeds out from there to where other people can start wearing it and symbolizing it, because the International Diabetes Federation has given them permission to, and wants them and encourages them to use the blue circle. But each one of them had told me they're trying to brand their own business. And from a diabetic's perspective, it was disappointing, because I want to brand diabetes, not a company.
Oh God, that's so gross. Like, we don't need, and it's gross. And also, because things are never black and white, and it's never either or, it's yes and always. That's disgusting. And also, why? Like, I love the work that the ADA does. I love the work that JDRF does. I love the work that Beyond Type 1 and Type 2 are doing. Mm-hmm. And also, what? Like, why? It is just like that. I didn't know that. Like, I didn't know that you offered to fund it and that you're, like, rallying for this. And they were like, hey, no, thanks for branding ourselves. Like, I was thinking, like, as soon as I ordered the hats, you're here. As soon as I ordered the hats and they were green, I was like, they should be blue. And the next round is going to, the next round is going to be blue, because the color within the Take a Hike Diabetes program on our educational platform, that color is diabetes blue. Like, it is the color code from the International Diabetes Federation. Because as soon as you said that, I was like, I don't need this to be hiking my feelings green. I really don't. Like, I want this to be blue, and I want to start doing it now. So next batch of hats, next batch of merch, as soon as I'm not going to make promises on merch, because we live in a van. So, like, our options are limited to drop shipping. We do not have an inventory warehouse somewhere. But as soon as I can responsibly source blue merchandise, that's going to happen. So I appreciate your advocacy in this space. I appreciate everything you're doing with Glucose Revival. Where can people find you, and how can they stay in touch?
Well, and let me just say one more thing. I think it's important that we all do our own thing. In my city, we've got them to light up the main icons of the cities, their buildings blue for the month.
I saw that. You're so badass, dude.
Most businesses want to know about it. They just don't know about it. And so it's being able to ask them. I figure next year, I'm going to buy every high school blue socks for their football team, so that we can start there and so that we can grow from there, just so that we can take care of our own communities. Because our community, we have about 40, 50,000 diabetics in it. I think we can make a noise just with one city. And if we can get it to other cities, Southern New Mexico, who I'm speaking with tomorrow, they got buildings around their city that's lighting up blue. And I just love it. I guess the seeds going out. And yeah. So eventually, I mean, we're right at that 15-year mark for how old the diabetes blue circle is. But I mean, if it takes us 20 years, then it takes us 20 years. And I think the big picture is it's going to help at least the future diabetics. Yeah. So that's what I'm looking at. But to answer your question, we're at glucoserevival.com.
Perfect. And I think even though we're hiking around Chicago next year for the Take a Hike Diabetes campaign, I know June is not Diabetes Awareness Month, but I'm going to ask the Sears Tower and John Hancock Building if they'll light up blue. I'm going to figure that out. That's on my list of things to do, because that would be super fun.
I hope I can join you in June.
Yes, that would be amazing. Everybody's invited.
Yeah. Well,
awesome.
Careful what you say, because you might get a few.
That's good. Everybody's invited. I mean that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Chris, have an excellent flight. Thank you for pulling over and making it happen for us tonight. We appreciate you. And I will really look forward to the day that we get to go adventure together. So thank you for everything you do. We love you and appreciate you deeply.
Continue, Sydney.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Adios. All right, Gabacha. Let's do this. You ready?
Let's do this. Yeah. First of all, thank you guys for sharing all that. I mean, I think there's just a level of courage that I think it takes to put yourself out there through your struggle and just kind of get over that for the benefit of the community at large. So I really admire that from both you and Chris. So I just wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay, so hi everyone, I'm Gabachia. I'm the Director of Social Responsibility at Hiking My Feelings, and Sydney asked me to come and talk about a couple of, I guess, outdoor ethics and land acknowledgement and also the so-called 10 essentials. So I actually made a presentation. So Sydney, do you want to give me power to present?
You are ready to go, girlfriend.
Okay, awesome. Let me see how can I do this? Is this my first time or what? Okay, here we go. Awesome. So.
Before you get started, this looks so good. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a quickie, but I figured we all learn in different ways. So for people that are more visual, I also made a PDF of this available for Sydney, so we can upload it to our mighty network so everyone has access to it. So we're going to be talking about number one, land acknowledgements, number two, the 10 essentials, and number three, outdoor ethics. So land acknowledgements, what are they? You probably noticed at the beginning of this call that Sydney took a moment just to recognize the peoples that have inhabited the place she is at and where Chris is at, and then she handed over to me so that I could also make that acknowledgement for the people of New Mexico. And what that is just really taking a moment of respect for the indigenous peoples who have cared for this land for time immemorial, time before colonization, and to also acknowledge that they are still here today. It is a gesture of inclusivity, and it is a very small but powerful step into remembering and normalizing indigenous names for everyone, because a lot of them have been erased from our local histories. And like a couple of times have been said tonight, it is the right thing to do. So why should we care to practice land acknowledgements? I actually say why, I think I posted this on my Instagram today where I rephrase this question and say, why should we make them a habit? Number one, I want to point out that there's countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, where it's not only customary, but it's even policy to open events with land acknowledgements. So for more than 500 years, Native communities across the Americas and elsewhere have demonstrated so much resilience and resistance in the face of efforts of displacement, cultural and religious erasure, assimilation, genocide, and beyond. And they are still dealing with these issues today. So why practice a land acknowledgement? Because they're still here today and we need to offer recognition and respect to them. We also need to be accountable and counter the narrative of discovery and honor the true story of the people that were already here before our own ancestors. Also to recognize that there's systemic and institutional power that have oppressed them, which I just spoke about. Creating awareness of their presence where we are, to begin to repair relationships with Native communities and with the land, to remind people that colonization is an ongoing process with Native lands still occupied due to deceptive and broken treaties. And also to take a cue from Indigenous protocol and just opening up space with reverence and respect to inspire ongoing action and relationships, of course. And again, I'm reiterating to normalize Indigenous names which have been erased from our local histories. Now, if you want to start practicing your own land acknowledgements, there are some great resources online. You can obviously Google it. There is a great resource that I personally love that is nativeland.ca or nativelandnet on Instagram. And I'll post links to this stuff in the chat later. You guys can go put in your zip code, put in the national park you're visiting, and it will pull up it's not a definite list of peoples, but it is as close as they've been able to gather through the knowledge of the people that have been participating in this project of putting together maps that show kind of boundaries of history and relationships between Native communities. And let's move now to the 10 essentials. Sorry, I'm kind of speed firing through it, but I feel like I just want to put everything out there and then maybe we could just have a Q&A or if you guys have any thoughts on this stuff that we can expand on. So the next thing, actually, before we go into the 10 essentials, there's something else that I want to say, because when you start hearing land acknowledgements, especially in this country where it's not customary, it might feel a little weird, or you may start to wonder, why do I need to do this land acknowledgement? Like, maybe I just told you all these reasons why, but that doesn't quite resonate with you because you don't have a firsthand experience of the same circumstances as Native communities have. So I just want to say, pay attention to those thoughts when you hear or see a land acknowledgement, when you first start doing land acknowledgements yourself. This is a really good opportunity for introspection and finding those systems of oppression within you. So be honest with yourself. It's okay if you're a little resistant to it. It's good. Let those thoughts out, but take some time to analyze them. That's where your growth is going to come from. Okay, now we can move to the 10 essentials. These are vital for a safe trip anywhere, whether you're on a day hike, whether you're on overnight hike, whatever it is that you're doing outside. I love to carry all my 10 essentials. In Mexico, we have a saying that goes, una mujer preparada vale por dos. That means one woman prepared equals to having two. So like as if, you know, one woman counts as two women if she's prepared. So I always like to be that woman. I would say if one person is prepared, they count for two people. So let's all be prepared. And we're pretty much always ready to help each other out in that circumstance. And then I also added a little bit of what to add to your 10 essentials in the times of COVID. Okay, so what to bring on every hike? Your navigation. It's important. So that's your map, your compass, your GPS device, your personal locator beacon or satellite messenger. You can get really fancy with that. You can get really basic with it. I would say at least have a map of the place. Bring a compass if you know how to use it. It's not going to be very helpful if you don't. And then obviously our cell phones are such a powerful tool that it's just the easiest navigation tool. But even though I do rely a lot on my phone, I always try to bring a map. And if I cannot find a map, I normally will even just take a photo of those maps at the beginning of a trail and just make sure that I have that for loose reference, just in case. Headlamp, obviously important. And with that, bring some batteries just in case. You never know. Sun protection, your sunglasses, your clothes, your sunscreen, hats. I cannot stress enough how it's best to hike in long sleeve, not only because it will protect you from the sun, but also because it will keep you hydrated for longer, because it won't let the water from your body just dissolve into air right away. First aid. That includes foot care. So anything that you might need for your blisters. It also includes your insect repellent and any allergy medication. And then of course, if you have diabetes, anything that you are using to mitigate that, you must certainly have that be part of your first aid kit, which thanks to Chris, it can also just be a necklace, which I love. A knife. Honestly, a knife just has so many different uses that, number one, I always think of self-defense, but I always hope that I will never use it for that. And I always just end up using it for either repairing things or for food. But it's just good to have one at hand. You never know. Fire. Don't actually bring a fire with you, but bring things that you can make fire with in case of an emergency. Matches, lighters. They sell waterproof matches at any, I think even some drugstores will have them, but obviously any outdoor retailer type of place will have fire items that are particular to the outdoors. But you can also just get the lighters from the grocery store. I mean, that's what I normally have, just lighters everywhere. And I kind of have, I'm compulsive about it. I think I just have like a lighter in the front pocket, a lighter in the inner pocket, a lighter in my first aid kit, just lighters everywhere. You never know. Shelter. This, you might think, well, if I'm not doing an overnight, do I need to bring a shelter? Honestly, you don't know. I would bring one. And I'm not saying like bring a tent every time you go hiking. I actually buy one of those little emergency blankets. They don't take any space. They don't weigh anything. And you are just always ready to stay out. Because something that you need to consider, for example, the one time that I thought I was going to have to use it and that I was just going on a day hike was because somebody else had a situation where they couldn't hike out. So when they asked, like, can anybody stay the night with this person until we can get the medics or the first responders come up tomorrow night or tomorrow morning, I was able to say, I'm okay staying here because I knew I had my emergency blanket. Okay, extra food and extra water. I mean, that's pretty straightforward, but you have no idea how important it is. Even in the story that Chris just shared with us, somebody running out of water, never okay. You bring extra food, you bring extra water, and then one really good precaution to take in terms of water is once you are done halfway through your water, you turn around and you go back. Okay, extra clothes, that too. I don't always bring extra clothes, but I would at least bring an extra pair of socks. And I had to learn that the rough way, but it's actually part of the 10 essentials, as you can see. So should be very self-explanatory, but sometimes we need to experience it the hard way. If you don't bring extra clothes, what's going to happen is maybe you're going to have to stay wet for longer than you need to. And then that leads to all sorts of respiratory issues in your feet. If you're not changing your socks right away, that's going to be terrible. A combination of monster blister and trench foot. You don't want to go there, pretty much. And then I added the also famous 11th essential, which is bringing a trash bag. And I called these the 10 essentials, and then I put the 11th essential because I also wanted to, just share that little bit of outdoor slang that you'll hear people talking about, the 10 essentials or the 11th essential. So this, I guess, has been added into our cultural psyche in the last couple of years, bringing a trash bag so you can pack not only for your own trash, but it's mostly to pack out other trash that you're most likely going to find when you're out there. And that also takes us back to leaving things better, or no, it takes us to leaving things better than we found them, which we'll get to in the outdoor ethics section of it. But I also wanted to mention some things to bring because we live in the times of COVID. So very clear, very standard things that you take everywhere else, like your face mask and your hand sanitizer. I also added disposable gloves to, well, actually my first aid kit already had a pair, but I'm adding extras. You want to have some because you never know if you're going to have to help someone or if somebody is going to have to help you, you also want to be able to equip them. So disposable gloves, a must, and then extra face masks, because again, you never know. It could be for you, but it could also be for somebody else. And down to the outdoor ethics. Leave no trace. How and why? Leave no trace, it's kind of a, what can we say, the umbrella term that most outdoor recreationists and conservationists will use to refer to our outdoor ethics. But also the Leave No Trace Center is an organization that is dedicated to doing research and to partner up with our land management agencies to come up with innovative ideas and education and skill building techniques to help us care for the outdoors and to help us minimize our impacts when we're out there. So they really focus on educating people, and they really think that it's better to do prevention than to be having to restrict access to places because of overuse or to have to come up with very expensive restoration projects because we didn't take care of our outdoor spaces. Okay. And so they've come up with 7 principles that kind of guide how we behave when we are outside. Number 1 is planning ahead and preparing. That means knowing anything from the weather of where you're going to whether the roads are open or closed. In the times of COVID, definitely know what facilities are open and which ones aren't, because right now that's not very clear and it's kind of ever changing across the board. So sometimes you might think, oh, I live in the border with this state, so I'm just gonna go to that state park tomorrow. And guess what? You get there and state park is only open to residents, or state parks are closed, or you know, visitor center has the restrooms closed, and you have to be able to to be prepared for all those situations. So planning ahead is a big one. And that also includes packing your 10 essentials. Don't be like me that leaves your sunblock at home on a long 6-day hike. It's not fun. Number two, travel and camp on durable surfaces. That's pretty self-explanatory, but just to say, obviously, your number one durable surface to travel is always the trail. Stay on the trail as much as possible. Only leave the trail if you absolutely have to, or if you can do it through a durable surface, which would be rock or sometimes sand, depending on the environment. Again, if you've planned ahead and you've prepared, then you know the vulnerable ecosystems that you're going to come in contact with, and you should be able to make better judgments. But just, you know, if it's rock, you can definitely hop over and maybe take a detour and find a better photo or whatever it is that you're looking for. But if it's vegetation, that can be super fragile and it can take decades to recover just from a couple of tramples. So absolutely trying to avoid vegetation. And sometimes there are certain kinds of soils that are also very precious and that take hundreds of years to create this special bacteria to protect microenvironments that we cannot even imagine in our heads. So it's just good to know which environment you're going and sticking to the trail as much as possible. And when you're camping as well, if you see that there's a pre-established camping spot, you'll see it because it's super flat, it's super clean, you can tell that there's been tents there, that's where you want to put your tent. You definitely don't want to start a new impact zone if there's already an impacted area. So those are things to consider. Disposing of waste properly, that obviously is for you as much as for your pets. The most popular, I would say, way to dispose of your own personal solid waste is to dig a hole that's at least 6 inches deep. And they sell little shovels that are, they have a name, but I cannot think of it. Trowels, yes, that's the name, that you can take in your backpack. They're super light. They help you do your little hole. You squat down, let everything go, and then, you know, cover it up, pack out your toilet paper. And then, so that's kind of like the most popular way. I would say before you get to the point where you need to actually make a cat hole to use it, make sure you just try making a cat hole, like just for fun, like see what it's like, because every soil is different, every terrain is different, and you have to be able to manage the time that you need to create that hole and the time that you need to dispose of your waste. So that's just a tip from me. Practice your cat hole before you ever go out on the first time. And then another way that you can do that responsibly is buying what they call a WAG bag. And these they sell at REI or backcountry.com. We're not sponsored by either of these, so take your pick. Just Google WAG bag and see where you can buy one of those. And for a WAG bag, you basically dispose into the bag and then close it and then dispose of it once you are away from the wilderness. There are areas that require you to take all your personal waste out, including your human waste. So part of planning ahead and preparing, you would know that. You would know that you need to bring a WAG bag to a certain hike if it's required. Number four, leave what you find. Not only because it's actually illegal in all national parks to take any resource, even a little pebble or a little rock or a little flower that you thought you could pick from the ground, it's actually illegal from federally protected lands, but also because if you see something that's beautiful, that strikes you, if you leave it there, then the next person can have that experience too. And if you take it, then no one else can have it. And so that's not kind of nice. So that's, again, like back to more the moral principle aspect of our relationship with each other, but also with the land. You know, everything is in such delicate balance that even when we say, oh, rocks are a durable surface and you can hop on rocks and get somewhere else, if you were to move those rocks, you are disturbing the ecosystem. So leave things how you find them, where you find them. That's just beautiful practice, not just for the environment, but for each other. 5, minimizing campfire impacts. Being careful with fire, for sure, for yourself. As we know, the rates of most of the wildfires are caused by humans. So that tells us that we are not to be trusted with fire. And therefore, there's two things, right? We either really learn how to manage fire, or we just don't mess with it. In my household, me and my partner have a rule where we really don't make a fire unless we absolutely have to. And the truth is, I don't think we've made a campfire, like an actual campfire, in like 2 years, just because we haven't had to. So obviously it's a privilege, it's a pleasure, it's a luxury, and you can have one, you can safely have one. Make sure that if you do, try to have local wood so that you're not bringing other agents into the ecosystem. And make sure that, again, you know the regulations. There are some states like California that you need to have certain certifications. Those are easy to get. You can go online, do a test. They give you a little paper that says that you know how to manage campfires, and just do it as responsibly as possible. 6, respecting wildlife. That is obviously including not getting too close to them, not throwing rocks at them so they look into your camera viewer. No feeding them. That's a really big no-no. Speaking of diabetes, I verbatim heard from a Yosemite National Park ranger that their squirrels have diabetes because they have consumed so much human food. So please don't feed the wildlife. It makes them sick. It disrupts their natural way of being in balance with their environment. And it can also disturb them to the extent of getting, of becoming dangerous to humans. And they may not become dangerous to you, but they may become dangerous to the next human that doesn't want to feed them. So respect them, keep your distance. There are multiple distances recommended per different kind of species. I like to just keep as much distance as possible. Even beware of cows on the trail. Let me tell you, I've been attacked by cows on the trail too. So anyway, just respect wildlife. It's good practice. And last but not least, be considerate of other visitors. And I'm going to expand that and say, and be considerate of the people that have stewarded the land before we had to protect it. Right? Because something that I always think about when I go and recreate at a national park or a state park or a monument is that before these lands had to be protected, they were sacred. So now going back to where we started with our land acknowledgements, being considerate of the peoples that have been in a place for time immemorial is super important. Even if it's not saying an acknowledgement for the world, just for yourself, it will also enhance your experience visiting a specific place. And then being considerate of everyone else that's there. If you practice all these principles, you're already being considerate of people that are coming the day after you, the decade after you, the centennial after you. So that's very important for obvious reasons, but then also for everyone who is there with you at that time, being considerate is super important. giving each other a friendly smile. Even through our masks, we can give each other friendly smiles and welcoming hellos on the trail, and try to again, I'm gonna go back to the last comment that I made when we were talking about land acknowledgements. Look deep within you when you are recreating outside. If you see folks that make you feel a certain way, whether they're making you feel unsafe, or they make you feel like they don't know what they are doing, but you do, watch those thoughts and think about what are the things in those other visitors that are triggering certain weird feelings in you. Because I think you'll learn a lot about your own, again, systems of oppression within you, but also your own prejudice and your own biases. Extras, just the quickies. Know yourself. Going out there, you never want to be using the 100% of your capacity. I would say go at 50%, and then you'll always have another 50% to rescue yourself. And I learned this from my motorcycle training. I thought it was genius. I'm like, yep, that's great. Why would you ever want to be always performing at your top? Because then you don't have anywhere else to go. So know yourself. And then piggy bank on that is challenging your limits in a gradual and safe way. So if you know yourself, you will know what that gradual challenge is, but don't try to go from beginner level, you know, bouldering at the gym to doing El Cap overnight. That's probably not smart. Then learn on and off the trail. So while getting outside gives you tons of information, the more that you can study or watch shows that are instructional, or I mean, there's plenty of shows that are entertaining that have tons of great information that will inform your experience when you're on the trail, and will also make it safer, and it will just also make it more well-rounded. So if you got thoughts, questions, or stories to share in relation to any or all of these things, please share. You can email me at gabache@hikingmyfeelings.org, and I'll be super happy to have all these conversations with you all. Last but not least, I just put a couple of resources here so that you can go ahead and continue to learn all your off-trail preparations. Whew, that was a mouthful, you guys. Thanks for bearing with me.
Crushed it. All right, everybody put on your cameras if you got questions. Now we're done. We're done with presenting. We're done with all the like all the official business. So let's yeah. Say hi and see everybody.
Actually, let me send you all one thing just because I'm really excited about it. Recently, I had the great opportunity to consult and translate for Leave No Trace Center. And we just came up with some Leave No Trace basics that are live on the website. And I just put the link on the chat so you can go check those out. They are kind of like it's not even a summary of the 7 principles. It's mostly the 4 most needed areas of help in outdoor recreation that we are facing right now as the increase of traffic into our natural spaces due to COVID. So I just dropped that link on the chat for you guys, and check it out. English and Spanish available.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So a couple things that I was thinking of, like for starter discussion points, on the, do you need to bring a shelter? So like you said, you don't need to like carry a tent, but one of the things that is really helpful about that 11th essential, bringing a trash bag, if it's one of the big trash bags, like don't unravel it until you need it.
True.
And you can use that as a shelter. So when I did a survival course at Becoming an Outdoors Woman in Montana last year, that was one of the things that they gave us, was a big orange trash bag. 1, it's good for shelter. 2, it's good for picking up trash. And 3, it's good for signaling. If you get lost and search and rescue is trying to find you, then if you have a big orange trash bag, that's something that will stick out amongst like all the natural colors. And on that note too, so royal blue apparently is the color that you can see for the furthest distance. So if you're looking for, if you're like upgrading your gear or anything like that, and royal blue is an option, that's a really good point for visibility.
That's great. That's a great point. I love the idea of a trash bag. Like if you always have it, you're kind of always ready. The reason why I'm such a pusher for this, like, soul, like emergency blanket is because I get cold so easily and I cannot sleep if I'm cold. And I've actually used my emergency blanket inside my tent because the temperature randomly drops so drastically that my setup with my liner and my sleeping bag wasn't enough anymore. So hopping in the emergency blanket in the middle of the night has like saved me in that level as well.
Yeah, and those pack up really small too. Like you can get them and they're like big.
Yeah, they're like my fist. They're very small. Yeah.
That's really cool. Awesome. Does anybody have any questions? Because I know that was a lot of great information. Any questions, any experiences that you want to share? Anything like that?
I have a question.
Hit it, Alexis.
Hi, good to see y'all.
It's like 2-3 days in the world. Like, I don't know how many days I've seen you this week, but I'm obsessed. Yeah, it's been three. I'm obsessed with this. Let's keep it going.
Love it. On the gear side, so the knife essential. Just curious to know what you guys have and what's been useful. I don't have one, so maybe I'll consider getting something.
Mine is attached to my fishing fanny pack, so it's in my truck, ready to go, because I just like, and you'll probably see, if you start seeing all my photos, you're like, yeah, she always has it, and like I always have it like ready to go, like I'm not even messing around, like I don't have to look for it, it's just always right here. I have a fixed blade, so it's not, you can choose like the ones that open and close, or you can have a fixed blade, which is just, you know, and like a sheath that you can put on your belt or on your straps or however it is that you'll start, you know, I think you just have to get one. I don't think there's a wrong one to start with.
That's Halloween, kidding me.
She's giving you all the Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th. I'm showing you my knife. So this is the one so Gabacha has a fixed blade. This is a fixed blade too. So this is a Sog Seal Pup and it's got a little bit of a serrated edge. It's got a really, really sharp edge. And then the point is excellent for puncturing blisters. So I carry sanitizer with me all the time. So I would just like sanitize the tip of this, sanitize my toe, and then use this to puncture the blister and let it drain. You can also do that, like grab a safety pin and like make it like take your lighter to the end of it to get it cleaned up. But that's just another helpful tip. But yeah, so this has a strap on the back. So Barry just has this mounted like on his chest or on his like hip belt, depending on what makes sense for which backpack he's got on.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. And then
the ones that fold in, those normally already have a clip. So you can clip those very easily in places. I've actually lost those knives before. So that's why I just have the fixed blade now, but it works for other, like my boyfriend has one of those and he just has it all the time.
And there's also a thing called a multi-tool or a skeletool, which can be, Michelle said it looks like a Rambo knife. She's right. So multi-tools and skeletools, they are lighter weight and pack up smaller. And it depends on which one you get, but that can also include like tweezers, a screwdriver, scissors. Like it's like a Swiss Army knife, but with a better knife than a Swiss Army knife from what I gather. Okay. That's on my list of things I want to get for my pack just to have. And most of those usually have like some kind of like fire starter kind of like thing as well. So that
the multi-tools are great. The one that I normally have in my in my 10 essentials pack, which has like 20 essentials, more like it, but I always have a Swiss Army knife. But I have that multi-tool is on my list. I definitely want to expand, because I like the Swiss Army knife because it's so small and it has a couple of different things. You can even open wine with it.
Which is important on the trail.
You never know when you're going to find a bottle of wine.
And then so something else I was thinking about, what was it? So I love the part about land acknowledgements was super informative. Thank you, Gabacha. And the part about it being customary, if not policy, if not like borderline law, to do a land acknowledgement in other countries, I think is spectacular. And I know that's one of the things that we've been improving here at Hiking My Feelings, especially on Instagram. We've been gotten really consistent with acknowledging the land from the pictures that we share when we know it. Because like if we're using like user generated photos or photos from sponsors, like I don't know where that tent was in that forest from UST, but I know where I was on the picture ahead of it. So I think that's really cool. And then just doing the land acknowledgements before we start doing meetings, that's something that it's on my now on my checklist of things to do. So I just love it so much. And it's really like when you were talking about how it deepens your practice and your like understanding and your connection with nature, I couldn't agree more. And the first place where I really felt that was in Yosemite. So if you haven't been to Yosemite National Park, they have a really great exhibit. And by really great, I mean absolutely tragic to think about what white folks did to that valley, where they talk about like how they came in, and they have this exhibit with the old, like it's a mock-up of a village of the Miwok. So Miwok is one of the tribes in the Yosemite Valley. And so they show like what structures used to look like they have a sweat lodge, they have some some like commerce type stuff, and then they have these exhibits where you can like listen to stories, and there's like this audio of a young Indian girl or young Native girl who's talking about how like the white man came in and offered her a yellow dress and like brought her these fabrics and textiles and all this stuff like to appease them. And then they talk about, and like the thing that makes me like, it's beautiful that they honor that history there and the way that they do and at all that that's shown. But the thing that makes me really upset is they talk about how the colonists or the colonial folks raised the village. If you don't know what raised means, you're like, oh, cool. Sounds great. Like what a fun thing. Raised is burned down, like all the way down to the ground. Like they just murdered everybody and burned everything down and then took over. So I think as part of my experience in Yosemite, like I went through, I did a hike. It was gorgeous. I was like, oh my God, like I've never cried in nature before. I cried when I saw El Cap the first time. And then I cried at the top of Eagle Peak because it hurt my legs so much to get up there. But to go to the visitor center after that hike, having just experienced like the land and all of its majestic glory and like understanding that the trails that are there were used by people for thousands of years before it was a park. Then to learn about the history just really reinforced the beauty of the space. And like a lot, I give myself some time to just like sit and imagine what it must have been like to be the first people on that land and to call that space home. And that's a really beautiful way to like deepen your connection with the land and respect the people that have stewarded it for so long. So I really just, that's a long way of saying thank you, Gabacha, because that section of the presentation was lovely.
Oh, you're welcome. Just one last thing. I actually have to head out because I have a volunteer thing with Desert Institute next. And I think the speaker is waiting for me. But yes, I really appreciate everyone's time today. I hope you start practicing your land acknowledgements. Above all things, really, like if anything you take from today is that just knowing for yourself where you are, who's been there before, who's still there today. That's a good first step, but don't stop there. There's more to do. There's action, there's relationship. There are the local native organizations that you can support and use your exploration of the lands through history to then propel yourself to become more involved and figure out ways in which you can relate and empower those communities today.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you, Gabacha. And thank you, everybody. I appreciate you spending your Friday night with us.
Thank you for joining us around the virtual campfire. Sometimes we talk about heavy topics. Sometimes we tell poop stories. But regardless of what we've discussed, we always like to end the show on a high note. At the end of our live broadcasts, we invite our community to share what they're grateful for in a segment called the Group Gratitude Circle. Every week, I'm thankful for you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy life to connect with us and witness these stories of hope, healing, and inspiration in the outdoors. If you'd like to gather with us around the campfire live each week, join the Hiking My Feelings virtual campfire VIPs. If this were a legit talk show, you'd be sitting in our studio audience. We haven't been picked up by a major network yet, so for now, we gather on Zoom. Here, you can connect with the community before and after the broadcast, hang out for sound check when we have musical guests, participate in the Q&A, join in on the group gratitude circle, and be eligible to receive prizes and gifts from our sponsors, partners, and guests. Learn more and join us at hikingmyfeelings.org/campfire. Don't forget to leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends, family, colleagues, and anyone else who could use a dose of community and connection. Follow us on Instagram, we're at hikingmyfeelings, and you can tag your journey with #hikingmyfeelings. And if you're picking up what we're putting down and you want to be part of this movement, join the Hiking My Feelings family at family.hikingmyfeelings.org. In case nobody told you lately, you are a brilliant human who is destined to do epic things in this world. Join us next week for more stories of hope, healing, and inspiration in the outdoors. Until then, happy trails!